Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silconet, and I'm back in Edinburgh after a very long, month-long hiatus. And I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cagliano, who is back at his American headquarters in Charlottesville, Virginia. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great today, David. I'm glad you're safely home.
Yes.
I imagine it's a little bit cooler back in Edinburgh than it was in North Carolina and other places you were.
I was wearing shorts and T-shirts, a couple days ago, and now I'm wearing a flannel and a coat and all kinds of nonsense.
I can't wait to get home to Scotland. I'm so tired of the heat here already. It's only May.
It is only May, but it feels very Scottish today. I want to apologize to listeners for not having an episode up the past couple of weeks as a consequence of my travel schedule and Frank's various travelings. We didn't have a good internet connection or time to record an episode, so apologies for that. Right. So in the 2 weeks since our last episode, the redacted version of the Mueller report has dropped, and everyone, I assume, has read bits and pieces of it, or if you've got a lot of spare time, the whole thing. In the 2 weeks, there's been some discussion among Democrats that this should culminate maybe in the impeachment of President Trump, or at least the possibility thereof, whereas Republicans are saying the Mueller report vindicates the president and that we should close the door on that particular avenue of inquiry.
Yes, Mitch McConnell last night declared case closed on all of this.
So whether the case is closed or not politically remains for the future, but I thought it'd be a good opportunity to talk about the history of impeachment and see if we can put recent events into some kind of context to see what standards people have used in the past.
I think it's fair to say, David, we've been holding an episode of impeachment in abeyance more or less for – since January of 2017, wondering when we would need to say it. And I think we've reached that point because certainly Elizabeth Warren and some of the Democratic candidates are talking about impeachment. And so I think we need to provide some historical context. Now, I think we're waiting. I mean, I think the one thing we're going to hold back and we'll need help from our colleagues is we'll have to have a bumper Watergate episode eventually, because I think that's where we're going. But we'll hold that off for the time being.
All right. So I think we should start off by, I think most people have some vague conception of what impeachment is and how it works, but I think we should have a refresher course for everybody. So what's the constitutional basis for impeachment? How does this game work, Frank?
Well, Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution says the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And the process the Constitution outlines for this is that the House of Representatives would adopt what are called articles of impeachment in the case of such treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors. And then there will be a trial in the Senate, and the trial in the Senate would result in the removal of an individual from office if two-thirds of the senators, so today it would require 67 senators, vote to convict the individual. So you can have a case, and we'll undoubtedly get to these in the next few minutes, where a majority of senators vote to remove somebody, but not a two-thirds majority. And so it's a very high bar that has to be met. So on one hand, the Constitution is not clear about what impeachment is, because we have this phrase, high crimes and misdemeanors. On the other, the process by which somebody's removed from office via impeachment is quite clear. So it's a majority of the House of Representatives votes to adopt articles of impeachment. It's essentially, to use legal language, an indictment. Mm-hmm. And then the trial is held in the Senate. And this is, and again, we'll get to this.
And presided over by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Yes, that's
so
right.
One of these weird places where you actually do have all three branches of government
coming together. That's right. And the trial managers, as they're called, the people who actually act as the lawyers in the case, come from the House of Representatives. So the trial's in the Senate, but there's input from both the House of Representatives and the Supreme Court. That's an excellent point, David. That's right. So that's the mechanism.
All right. So we've got this phrase in the Constitution here about there's bribery and there's treason. Okay, I think I get what those are, and especially since the Constitution does define treason. Let's talk about high crimes and misdemeanors? Because I think that requires maybe some more elucidation. What is that? What are high crimes and misdemeanors mean?
Well, as with many matters legal, precedent is important here. I mean, impeachment goes back to English common law, but as it was interpreted by the framers of the Constitution, this is a fairly broad category or unclear category. We get some elucidation from everybody's favorite Broadway star, Alexander Hamilton, on this in one of the Federalist Papers, in Federalist number 65. And the Federalist Papers, as many listeners will know, were a series of essays that Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay wrote during the debate over the Constitution in New York, and they appeared in the newspapers, and the intention was to influence the debate, encourage people to vote in favor of the Constitution, but they provide one of the most important contemporary interpretations of the Constitution we have. And in Federalist number 65, in discussing impeachment, Hamilton says, he talks about what high crimes and misdemeanors are, and he says that it is, quote, misconduct of public men, or in other words, from the abuse or violation of some public trust. So it's a much lower bar, it seems, than treason, which, as you say, is defined in the Constitution, bribery, which we think we know what it means. But this is more, as I said, Hamilton uses this phrase, misconduct and a violation of some public trust, to describe it. So what we get is, from the outset, I think, is a fairly flexible definition. Yeah. And I think, you know, this is a legal process, but it's also a political process. One thing
people misunderstand about high crimes and misdemeanors is they think it means it's a very serious, I mean, they think high crimes as being a serious crime, and that's not what that means. At least that's my understanding.
So how do you understand it?
So I understand high crimes to be crimes that are committed as a consequence of your holding political power, right? That these are a category of crimes that are, or of behaviors that are fundamentally intertwined with holding the executive or other offices. So I cannot commit a high crime because I have no political power.
You cannot
commit any high crime. You know, it's something that is embedded within office holding.
Right. You're the president of SASA, though, the Scottish Association.
That's true. I could be impeached for gross incompetence, probably. But
So the high there refers to the, in your reading, the adjective high refers to the office held, not to the crime.
Yes.
Interesting. Interesting. I mean, that's a fair reading of it. And of course there is, and misdemeanors. So even if we take high crime to mean, you know, murder or what have you, misdemeanors by definition are lesser crimes.
Yeah. Some people, when they've tried to sort of parse this, and I remember hearing this a great deal during the Bill Clinton impeachment hearings, like whether lying under oath was a high crime. I think people are misunderstanding exactly what crime and high crime meant in that particular context. Because, you know, when it gets used in English common law, and it has these roots going back to the 14th century, it's about, you know, misappropriating government funds or, you know, dereliction of duty and those kinds of things. If you look at sort of the long history of impeachment in the British common law context, you know, it's for fairly banal things like not showing up to work on time or not showing up to work at all. It's not a higher threshold of crimes than you and I are susceptible to. It's about sort of powers deriving from office. At least that's the way I'm reading it. And I think
One way to look at this, because again, precedent matters, is to consider how the contemporaries who drafted the Constitution, so either the men who drafted the Constitution or their political and legal contemporaries, employed this and enforced it in the first years of the Republic. I think that's germane because we get some sense for what it might be. So there are only a few cases. Impeachment is relatively rare in the early Republic. But if you'll indulge me for a second, maybe I can run through those because it might help us to understand how they understood it, that makes sense.
Of course, we've got the three big cases of impeachment that we're going to talk about, of presidents, you know, either being impeached or almost being impeached with you know, Johnson, Nixon, and Clinton. But of course, as we mentioned, as what you read earlier, impeachment is not just for the president. You can impeach other government officers, and that includes lots of judges, but also other people. And states also have similar mechanisms with a very similar standard of high crimes and misdemeanors. So lay on me some impeachments in the early Republic.
Let me give you some early Republic political malfeasance for you. So the very first time that the House of Representatives impeached somebody, it was in 1797, and the individual who was impeached was, and I should say, we talk about people being impeached, and I think that in the popular mind, people conclude that impeachment means removal from office, when actually, technically speaking, to be impeached is to have the House of Representatives vote on articles of impeachment or to vote in favor of articles of impeachment, thereby creating the trial. So in other words, Bill Clinton was impeached in 1998, but he was not removed from office.
Right.
So that's an important kind of matter that people should keep in mind as we have this discussion. So the first impeachment occurred in 1797 when U.S. Senator from Tennessee, William Blunt, was impeached on pretty good evidence that he was conspiring with the British to seize Spanish-controlled territory in modern-day Florida and the Louisiana Territory. This was a constant problem in the 1790s and the first decade of the 19th century, with political figures conspiring with either the Spanish or the British at various times to aggrandize themselves and acquire territory. And Blunt seems to have been involved in one of these conspiracies. The Senate trial was held in December, between December of 1798 and January of 1799. Eventually, the charges were dismissed because Blunt was no longer a U.S. senator, so there was no case to answer, because the punishment would have been his removal from the Senate. So although the House voted to impeach him in 1797, the trial, because Congress didn't meet that frequently back in the late 19th century, 18th century, the trial wasn't held for another year, and the case more or less collapsed because Blunt was no longer in office. A few years later, in 1803, the House voted to impeach John Pickering, who was a U.S. district court judge from New Hampshire. Pickering seems to have been a drunk and largely incompetent, and he was found guilty and removed from office in 1804. So that's the first case of somebody at the federal level, Judge John Pickering, being removed from office in 1804, more or less for incompetence and drunkenness on the bench. He also was accused of some personal corruption in terms of how he handled property claims. But basically, that was a competence issue. And to some extent, that's the kind of case that they inherited, I think, as you referred to a minute ago, from common law. I think that was in kind of keeping with that. The most famous case, though, in the early Republic occurs a year later. In March of 1804, the House votes to impeach Samuel Chase, and Chase is a justice on the Supreme Court. So the case against Chase is that he was basically arbitrary and oppressive in the way he conducted trials. And there is some evidence to suggest that actually Chase was arbitrary and oppressive in the way he conducted trials. But there was a political cast to this because Chase was a Federalist, and the Jefferson administration, and we've talked a little bit about this and we don't need to belabor it today, the Jefferson administration was kind of at odds with the judiciary during its day. It's not unlike what we see today, that the perception was that the judiciary, which was heavily influenced by Federalist appointees, was kind of out of step with the administration. And so there were a series of legal kind of entanglements between the Jefferson administration and various members of the judiciary. And the impeachment of Samuel Chase was seen as a kind of part of that. Interestingly, although the House adopted articles of impeachment in March of 1804, at Chase's trial, which was held between December and March of 1805, Chase was acquitted. And so that bar of two-thirds was not met. And so I think to some extent the Chase case is kind of anticipates some of the later impeachments we're going to talk about when we get to the various presidents, in that he was, if you will, politically indicted, but the standard for removing somebody from office, which is in the Constitution, is very, very high indeed. It's not a majority. It's two-thirds. You need to get two-thirds of the senators to vote. And in the case of Samuel Chase, that wasn't possible. So we have three early cases, one where somebody does seem to have engaged possibly in treasonous activity, but the case collapsed because he was no longer in office, so removing him from office didn't make sense. John Pickering is removed from office in what seems to be a fairly straightforward case of incompetence because he was impaired on the bench through his alcoholism. And then Samuel Chase is a more political case. And so I guess what emerges from the early republic, again, if we're thinking of that first generation's encounter with impeachment, it gives us a mind into how the framers understood impeachment. It's that the bar is very high. It's often a political act, but in order to remove somebody from office, they have to it has to be more than political, I think.
Well, I mean, but in thinking about those cases that you mentioned, I mean, the barrier seems to be the primary barrier to removing someone from office seems to be political more than it is sort of the conduct of the person, right? And just in comparing maybe the Pickering case and the Chase case, it almost sounds to me like Chase was a more problematic figure than Pickering was. I mean, I don't know how drunk he was or how incompetent he was as a judge. I guess that might matter, but...
Well, I mean, I think there are two things at work. I think he was pretty drunk and incompetent. I mean,
okay.
I think his incompetence was manifest. And so in the Pickering versus Chase, it's interesting because they're, again, both Federalist judges, so that there's the partisan aspect to it. But Pickering's incompetence is such that not even Federalists in the Senate will defend him.
Okay. Well, I guess given how much people drank in the 18th century, you know, if somebody is seen as a drunk by them, then they must be a...
He's a real drunk.
A real drunk, okay.
And the other thing that's important, I guess, is, of course... the Supreme Court doesn't have the high profile then that it, you know, it does now.
Sure.
But even so, there is a difference in level of these two guys. So Pickering was a district court judge, which is an important role, but it's not, you know, he was a tier below Chase, who was a justice of the Supreme Court.
Okay, that makes some sense. Okay.
If I can only make some sense, David, it's a good day.
Well, you know, that's yeah, you and me both. Right.
So looking forward, David, like, I mean, should we talk about the various presidents, because chronologically, you know, the big impeachment, which I think is really germane for Trump, is Andrew Johnson after the Civil War, and he's, you know, that's your stuff.
Yeah. So let's go with Johnson. So you know, the background to Johnson's impeachment, and he's impeached in 1868, is that Johnson becomes president when Abraham Lincoln is assassinated. Johnson was before the war, a Democrat from Tennessee, and he becomes Lincoln's vice president in 1864 as part of this unity platform during the Civil War to try to signal stance and Reconstruction and other things. But he becomes president when Lincoln is assassinated in April of 1865, and he immediately runs into conflict with Congress, which is overwhelmingly Republican, over the status and fate of Reconstruction, and his impeachment emerges from that struggle between him and Congress over the status of the Freedmen's Bureau and over the Civil Rights Acts that are passed in the 14th Amendment. Johnson actually actively campaigns against Republicans in Congress in 1866. And it's, you know, that political tension that ultimately culminates in his impeachment trial. He's put on, he's accused of basically, there's 11 charges that are put before the House impeaches him on, and then he has a trial in the Senate. Many of these, if you look at them, are actually deeply connected with one another. Congress had passed something called the Tenure of Office Act to protect cabinet members from being removed from office arbitrarily, saying basically if it's a person who's been confirmed by the Senate, they have to be, their removal also has to be confirmed by the Senate, which was a sort of a odd way of protecting sympathetic members of the cabinet. Johnson removes Edwin Stanton, who was the Secretary of War, against Congress's wishes, and that's number one on the list of articles of impeachment. The other ones are in some ways sort of ones that follow on from that about their the ways in which Johnson is impeding the actions of Congress with regard to the Tenure of Office Act. But the last two, I think, are interesting. Article number 10, making three speeches with intent to bring disgrace, ridicule, hatred, and contempt and reproach on the Congress of the United States. So he gave speeches in which he said bad things about Congress. And that seems to have been, in their minds, a legitimate grounds for. Number 11, bringing disgrace and ridicule to the presidency. Which, again, seems to be so the earlier ones are very specific about their charges. These last two are somewhat broader in their condemnation. The trial, as you would imagine, was this is the first time a president has been on trial in this format. It's obviously a major political event with lots of public interest. And this is he is narrowly acquitted. But of course, there's the two-thirds majority needed by votes. The votes on all the articles of impeachment are 35 to 19. So 35 people are voting guilty, 19 are voting not guilty, but you needed 36 votes to be removed from office. So in each case, he is saved by one vote. One of the things that happens consequentially to Johnson's impeachment is he is still then in office for another 2 years, but he, for all intents and purposes, stops doing those kinds of things that was causing Congress to be so frustrated with him and lead to his trial.
So David, I my interpretation of this, and you know more about this particular case than I do, but the way I've always thought of that is this is a key moment in the history of Congress's relationship with the president and the history of the presidency, because had Congress voted to remove Johnson, again, this is my interpretation, I'd be interested to hear what you think, I think we would, the United States would have a system kind of akin to a parliamentary system where a government can fall if there's a vote of no confidence in the leader. It would, you know, in other words, a political decision is made by the legislature, a parliament or particularly the party of the president, of the prime minister, to vote against them. If there's a vote of no confidence in most parliamentary system, the government falls and election is called. And we don't have that mechanism here in the United States, but had Johnson been removed from office for actions which both seem to be illegal and politically maladroit, then we would have had a lower standard for impeachment, as it were, and presidents could have been removed for political reasons, I guess. And so I think that in 1868 the Senate, rightly or wrongly, sets a pretty high bar for removal from office, and that's a kind of, if you will, a turning point. It's one reason why we are where we are today in terms of, and we'll get to it, the debate over whether President Trump should be impeached. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look at the party line voting in Johnson's impeachment, you know, the Democrats are all voting to acquit him. So there is, it is in some ways a very partisan act. And you know, the Senate's overwhelmingly Republican, so a handful of Republicans vote to acquit him as well. I think there's a couple of things that sort of lead to Johnson's impeachment. One is that this was a Reconstruction was a moment in time in which the country was confronted with a set of problems that the Constitution didn't anticipate. Right? How do you readmit states to the Union who had seceded from the Union, whether secession was constitutional or not, and all these other kinds of questions about how do you deal with pardons over large numbers of people, and there were frustrations there. I mean, when the Civil War ends and you have to deal with the questions of reintegrating the Union, the Constitution's pretty silent about how that's supposed to happen, because the guys in Philadelphia hadn't anticipated this was going to take place. And part of the fight is over who has the authority to make these kinds of decisions. You know, when Johnson takes office in 1865, he basically decides that Reconstruction is going to take place over the next 3 months when Congress is in recess, and says basically mission accomplished, to compare him to a later president. You know, and Congress has a very different view of where that sort of balance of power lies. You know, I think if you sort of charting the major narrative of power, the relative power of the presidency versus Congress, you know, in 1787, I think when they're drafting the Constitution, I think they very much think of Congress as being the more powerful of the two co-equal branches, if you can say that co-equal branches are more powerful than one another. And over the next 200 plus years, you've had a gradual strengthening of the presidency, and I think the Civil War is one of those moments in which the presidency does become potentially more powerful. Obviously, it's an office that does take on more powers during wartime, but and in the 20th century, that's when the real big growth in executive power is. But I think this is a moment of it.
Yeah,
I should also point out there are a number of impeachments during Reconstruction at other levels. This is a moment in time in which this mechanism is used fairly frequently at the state level, and for judges, in terms of people who are being removed for parliamentary reasons. You know, one of the more interesting ones is the removal of Governor Holden in North Carolina, who was removed from office the mechanisms at the state level tend to be very similar to the federal level. He is a Republican. He's removed by sort of impeached by the House of Representatives in North Carolina in 1870, and he is removed from office in 1871, mostly because he was hostile to the Klan. Right, and we tend to think of you know, impeachment for people doing bad things. In this case, this is somebody being impeached for what you know, we would think of as being a fundamentally moral stance, but you know, his fight against the Klan is what ultimately leads to his removal from office when conservatives take over the state legislature. So it seems to be a time in which there is a lot of where the tool of impeachment is used quite frequently.
Well, it's a time of great, as again, you know better than me, great political instability and fluidity. I mean, you've got new amendments to the Constitution. You're remaking the Union. You've got, you know, there's a lot going on that I think Reconstruction is many things, but it's also a kind of new constitutional settlement, if you will. It's not entirely unlike the early 1790s, in that there's a kind of new constitutional order and people are trying to figure out what it means.
That's a good point. I think, yeah, those are both moments in which the rules are slightly unclear, and you know, the boundaries of political power are likewise in flux, and people are sometimes pushing those boundaries, and that's I think probably why you end up with a sort of a flurry of impeachments in both situations. Shall
yes.
we then progress to the 20th century, which is...
Yeah, let's leave Richard Nixon aside for the time being, because although people think Richard Nixon was impeached, he was not.
He was about to be impeached.
And that's important, yeah. And that may be germane to our discussion about President Trump, so that's why I think we need to leave that aside, because the more relevant example, I suppose, or the more contemporary example that many of our listeners may even remember is, of course, the impeachment of Bill Clinton 21 years ago in 1998. Yes. And Bill Clinton was impeached for basically lying under oath as a result of the Starr investigation into his conduct in office with regard to his personal escapades, let's put it at that, and his relationship, which I'm definitely using air quotes for that, with Monica Lewinsky, and lying under oath about that. So basically, Bill Clinton was impeached for lying under oath.
Okay. Well, so, I mean, they are initially in the House, I think there are four charges against him, and they vote to approve two of them, if I'm recalling correctly. The two that get approved and taken on to the Senate, one is about lying to the grand jury, And the second one is about obstruction of justice.
That's right. And obstruction of justice might be relevant in the Trump case as well.
So the line of the grand jury, he's specifically charged with lying about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, about his false statements he made in the Paula Jones deposition, and his attempt to supposedly tamper with witnesses by encouraging them to false affidavits or testify fraudulently. And specifically, I think that's in reference to encouraging Monica Lewinsky to not reveal the totality of their relationship. And the obstruction of justice case also has to do with, I think, the Paula Jones situation. And it's about both trying to influence Lewinsky's testimony in that case and in his secretary trying to prevent his secretary, Betty Curry, from testifying against him in that situation. But those are the two cases, the two charges that get brought up in the Senate.
And the Clinton case, it seems to me, is a little bit similar to the Johnson case a century and a bit before, or 130 years before, in the sense that the House votes in favor of these articles of impeachment. A trial's held in the Senate. The stakes are much smaller. Well, they're not small for Clinton, but the issues are much smaller than they were in the case of Reconstruction during the Johnson impeachment. Mm-hmm. But Bill Clinton was not removed from office because they couldn't muster a two-thirds majority in the Senate. And as a consequence of that, he survives. And so we still, I guess, as I interpret that, we end up with a situation which is, again, similar to the impeachment of Johnson in that because of this very high standard, impeaching somebody because you don't like them politically, which seems to be some of the case against Bill Clinton, although the charges are serious and he's probably guilty. but people looked at the origins of those charges saying, well, he lied under oath, but yet he shouldn't have been under oath discussing these matters. That political standard is very, very – or that political legal standard is very, very high and difficult to meet, and this attempt to remove a president from office fails. And I think there are real echoes of the Andrew Johnson situation. Again, that's how I've always interpreted it. What do you think?
Well, there's the difference, I mean, I think is I think you're right in terms of there's lots of similarities between the two situations. The difference is, I think Johnson actually came close to being removed from office, right? So the vote for Johnson, was one vote away from him being removed.
Yeah.
And so I think one can imagine a scenario in which he actually would have been removed from office pretty easily. With Clinton, just in part because of the structure of the Senate at the time and the balance of power there, the likelihood of him actually being removed from office was pretty slim, right? And when they actually do have a vote, not only do they not get the two-thirds, they don't even get half. Because all the Democrats vote in favor of impeachment and a handful of Republicans also vote against impeachment. And so it's not even close to that. The difference I draw is I think of the Johnson administration as being a real constitutional crisis and a moment of political instability where things could have ended up differently. I think of the Clinton impeachment as political theater, where, I don't think, I think they were trying to win political points by going through the impeachment process. I don't think even the diehard Republicans who wanted Clinton out of office really expected that was a very likely chance.
So
I might be wrong about that but
no, I think you're right about that. And that therefore makes it, I mean, that's the precedent that Democrats have been referring to in the past couple of weeks since the Mueller report appeared, or the redacted Mueller report, about whether to proceed with the impeachment of Donald Trump. And I think that that's Jermaine, that the Clinton impeachment is very much on people's minds because it cuts two ways. On one hand, those in favor say, well, look, the Clinton impeachment was sets a very good precedent for impeaching Donald Trump's. It would seem, and perhaps I'm revealing a partisan bias here, that Trump's malfeasance far outweighs that of Bill Clinton. However, one of the arguments goes, well, yes, but the Democrats actually did better after Clinton's impeachment, and the impeachment of Bill Clinton hurt the Republicans. I'm not sure I agree with that narrative. But that the traditional view is if you impeach somebody and you fail to remove them from office, that's a political defeat, and therefore Democrats should avoid doing that for in the case of Donald Trump, because as it stands right now, there is no way he will be removed from office.
No,
because
not given
the 60,
yeah,
you know, yeah. The requirement of 67 senators to vote for the removal of Donald Trump, the Democrats would need all of their senators, all 47, to vote in favor of impeachment, and that's not assured with people like Joe Manchin. And then they'd need 20 Republicans, and that just seems politically impossible at the moment.
I think that's right. And, you know, I think not only are they making reference to the Clinton impeachment, but given, you know, how long some people stay in the Senate, there's a decent number of senators, you know, who have participated in that event who are still in the Senate. So, you know, their memory is, you know, quite pressing on this, you know. I think they know how all this works in a fairly intimate kind of way.
Now, Richard Nixon wasn't impeached, although articles of impeachment were drafted. Yet there were hearings that led to the drafting of those articles, and it seems certain that he would have been impeached and removed from office had the process gone ahead. And therefore, he got ahead of the posse, as it were, and jumped before he was pushed and resigned so that he wouldn't be the first, and it would seem to this point, only president removed from office this way. And so Nixon was able to kind of see the handwriting on the wall. I don't think Trump has that capacity. Interestingly, though, and I wonder if this is this too shouldn't be a lesson for the Democrats. The hearings that were held, the Watergate hearings that were held, led to a change in both public opinion and opinion within the House and Senate against President Nixon, because as the hearings went on to examine his high crimes and misdemeanors, the evidence that came out was quite compelling. So I think there is a case for beginning impeachment hearings with respect to President Trump, in part to get everything on the record, even if it doesn't result in formal impeachment charges. I'm swithering about whether the House should vote to impeach him or not. What do you think?
I mean, well, so thinking about, and we'll talk more about Nixon on a later episode, but considering, you know, the House Judiciary Committee there considered five articles of impeachment against Nixon, they end up turning down two of them, one on the bombing of Cambodia and the other one on a potential tax evasion situation. But the three that get passed are obstruction of justice, abuse of power, and contempt of Congress. And
ding, ding, ding.
Those sound very familiar to me, given not only events that are outlined, the events that are outlined in the Mueller report, but actually events of the past sort of 2 weeks since the Mueller report has come out, in terms of, you know, telling members of his administration not to testify before Congress for refusing to hand over subpoenaed documents, and on and on and on, right? So I think there's a if that's a framework for or a precedent for you know, the current situation, it seems to be very similar in many respects. Now there's then we have to sort of get to the you know, what happens with Nixon and Nixon's decision to resign, and to what extent are Nixon and Trump in the same situation. And I think part of what happened with Nixon is that Republicans, both in the House and the Senate, started to see public sentiment shifting and decided then to, you know, encourage the president to consider alternatives to holding office. But we're in a very different political moment today than we were in the early 70s in terms of the ways in which these parties are constructed, the ways in which party loyalty works. You know, there were moderate and liberal Republicans in the early 1970s. You know, we don't have that situation anymore where there's a, you know, there aren't any conservative Democrats and there aren't any liberal Republicans anymore.
No, there's been a real sorting of the parties.
So those, the party structures have become more polarized and more ossified in the past, you know, 40 plus years.
Yes, let's not forget that the media environment is very different because the existence of Fox News is crucial in this.
To be sure. And I guess the other difference, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but Nixon, I think, had a much greater sense of selflessness, and that's hard to say with Nixon, but than the current president does, right?
I think he saw some
damage being done to the country as a consequence of this, of the very lengthy hearings that were happening, and resigned for the benefit of the country. I don't see a similar course of action unfolding with President Trump.
No, I mean, I agree with you on that. I'm not sure selflessness is the word. Nixon, at some level, was an institutionalist. I mean, he was a lifetime politician. He'd served, you know, he'd served in Congress. He'd been a vice president. He'd been he'd had a number of political roles at some level, although he certainly sought to, you know, his behavior seems to me clearly illegal in many cases, and he subverted the Constitution. But at some level, he understood there were rules. And ultimately, when found out, you know, gave up.
And both written rules and unwritten rules and values. And I think even if he stomped all over them at various points in time, I think he recognized that they had, you know, some legitimacy. And so, you know, in playing the political calculus about whether to go forward with sort of preliminary investigations into impeachment or not, I think Democrats in the House are weighing whether Trump would respond to that kind of political pressure. Nixon did.
I think one of the reasons I can't make up my mind on this is, you know, if Trump is acquitted by the Senate, as he would undoubtedly be, at least as things stand at the moment. And I can't see, but for the reasons you've outlined, a change in that being likely. He would proclaim himself. He would say the Mueller report proved concluded there was no collusion, and now he's been found innocent. That's how he would present it. And that would come at a great, I think, cost, because as you say, he doesn't have he's not Nixonian in the sense that when presented with all the evidence, he would resign rather than face the humiliation of the trial and possible removal from office. And quite the contrary, he'd go through with it and proclaim victory, as he did after the Barr memo back in March in response to the William Barr's reading of the Mueller report before we all saw it. And that seems to me to be – there seems to be a real risk of that. On the other hand, he's going to do that anyway. Yeah. And that being the case, the historian in me thinks, you know what, we need to get as much of this down on the record while we can, and there's a process to do that, and we should hold hearings, and we need to hold hearings to set the record straight. And others have said this will be a distraction from the campaign for Democrats. Well, I think the Democrats have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. Many of those who are running for president, apart from the ones who are in the House of Representatives, and those are just the white guys nobody's heard of, and I don't think they're going to be around very long, like Seth Moulton and people like this. They're not the serious candidates at the moment. Most of the people running for president won't be directly involved in whatever impeachment hearings are held. And therefore, I think the campaign can go on at the same time that at least hearings go on and investigations into what the Trump administration has done. I do wonder whether Trump doesn't want to be impeached, because he does see his actions of the past week or so, you know, with telling his staff to ignore subpoenas and things like that, seem to be putting him on a kind of road of inevitable impeachment because the House won't have a choice to do anything but. But I wonder if he doesn't think that will play well to his base. And, you know, I think he thinks, knowing he won't be removed by the Senate, that this might benefit him.
Yeah, I mean, I think the political calculus of all this is complicated, in as much as, you know, public polling suggests that most Democratic voters want the House to go forward with impeachment, but the majority of voters overall don't.
That's right.
So, and part of this is as a consequence of all the polarization that we've talked about on this episode and many others. The interesting thing about impeachment is that it takes the structure of a trial, right? There it has these judicial aspects to it, whether it's, you know, the impeachment itself and then the trial that happens afterwards, and the fact that we refer to it as a trial and there's a judge presiding over it, and there's the mechanisms of a judicial process. But the standards are entirely political. That, you know, when it makes sense to impeach someone or not impeach someone is predicated not necessarily based upon an objective assessment of their actions, but based on broader political questions and the disposition of the jury. That is to say, who's in the Senate at the particular moment in time. So it is this very strange procedure in that respect. It both takes on this judicial tone, which we think of as being apolitical, but at the same time is explicitly and in some ways overwhelmingly political in its origins and its outcomes.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it appears to be a legal setting. And it has the form of that, but it's inherently and ultimately political.
All right. Well, we will see.
David, where do you stand on this? Do you think?
I think, like you, I vacillate about whether. So there's two questions for me. One is, do I think he has committed high crimes and misdemeanors? And the answer there would be yes. Because I think his actions, both during the campaign and actually subsequent to the campaign when he's been in office, are indicative of obstruction of justice, abuse of power, contempt of Congress. All of these things, I think, are the same things that Nixon was going to be removed from office for. So I think he meets that standard for me. And if you look at, you know, when we talked about the judges that have been impeached, or we look at the governors who've been impeached, the actions taken by President Trump over the past 2+ years are clearly fall within the rubric established by those precedents. Then the second question is, is it a politically wise thing then for Democrats to take action based on these? And there I'm, you know, again, my partisan leanings, I think, are evident to anyone who listens to this podcast. I'm not sure whether it's in their best interest to go forward with it. And I think Nancy Pelosi is doing a similar kind of reading right now, where, you know, at the moment I think she's said she's not in favor of impeachment, but I think that's partially because she knows that when it gets to the Senate it's going to fail. And so I don't know what's in the best interest of the country at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I find Nancy Pelosi you know, Nancy Pelosi is a very smart woman, and she's very good at what she does, and she's bested Trump in almost every encounter they've had, and I find that very compelling. On the other hand, I find equally or possibly even slightly more compelling Elizabeth Warren's position, which is there should be impeachment because it will require every single member of the House and Senate to vote. on this.
Yes.
And everyone will have to go down on record. And there will be, one hopes, life after Trump. But everybody will be forced to go on the record, to say, this is where I stand on this question. And, you know, and that serves a useful kind of political function, but frankly, a moral one as well. And I find Elizabeth Warren's position pretty persuasive on this. But then I think, well, Nancy Pelosi really knows what she's doing.
Yes.
And she's smarter than I am. Particularly,
and she's much smarter than I am. So yes, yeah. I think we're, I'm with you on the political expediency of this, and whether it's both in the interest of politicians with whom we have sympathies, and in terms of what's good for the country. I'm not sure. In as much as I understand what's good for the country, I'm not sure that, you know, impeachment trial is going to be I can't imagine what an impeachment trial would look like today, given the sort of Fox News, Twitter landscape that we have.
Yeah, I mean, I know we got to move on, but my counterargument is that, you know what? We're already tearing each other apart over everything, whether it's the Mueller report or the Barr hearings or when Mueller appears before Congress, which he will eventually. So it'll be just another, you know, another act in the circus. And if it's not, so let's do the right thing and get it all on the record.
That seems like a good point to end on. We will see how all this unfolds over the coming weeks and months. All right, so time for last drops, Frank. What you got?
Yeah, I'm just back from Dallas, David, where I appeared. I played a small role in something called the Old Parkland Debate Series. And the Old Parkland Debate Series are a series of debates that are held at this wonderful campus called Old Parkland, which is in Dallas. It's actually the site of the Old Parkland Hospital, where JFK was taken after he was shot. But we'll leave that aside. what I want to do, I moderated a debate between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. They usually have higher-brow debates than this. Well, it was a highbrow debate, but obviously, Jefferson and Hamilton weren't there. These were impersonators who were very, very good. Normally, they have debates between living political figures at Old Parkland, but
were they debating issues from the 18th century, or were they debating issues from contemporary?
I'll give you the question that they debated. It was resolved the federal government should assume the war debts of the states and establish a national bank. So they debated the issues of their day.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And they did a great job, and people loved it. But I really was, so I want to thank the host of this event, and I was just the moderator. I didn't play a very big role, except one of my key task I had as moderator was to call on a designated member of the audience, and we'd agreed in advance who this would be, because there was a flash mob during the question and answer period of the debate. There was a flash mob of very talented students from Texas Tech University, from the School of Theater and Dance at Texas Tech, who got up and then began performing songs from Hamilton.
Oh, okay.
And,
were they in costume too? Or
they were not in costume, because they were just there as members of the public, ostensibly. So this wasn't in the program. People didn't know what was happening. People were blown away. These kids were so talented. They were amazing. I want to give them a shout out, but I also have to give them an apology. This was videoed, so it's going to be on the internet eventually, because all of our embarrassments are. Because when I thanked them at the end, so I had two tasks, really. I had to moderate the debate. I had to call on this young guy and to start the flash mob, and I had to thank everybody at the end. Well, the thing had gone so well, and I was so transformed by their music and their performance that I actually said that they were from Texas A&M University rather than Texas Tech. Now, I corrected myself immediately. Well, I was corrected by the audience. So you'll be able to see that little piece of humiliation of me on the internet soon, and where it will live forever. But
listeners, we will post a clip when this becomes available.
However, if you'll indulge me, I'd like to acknowledge these students who were absolutely brilliant. And so they are from the School of Theater and Dance at Texas Tech University. And they were directed by Dean Nolan and Casey Keening Joyner. And the student performers were Cottrell Sutton. He was absolutely brilliant. He was the one I called on. Parrish Rebecca Dupre, Daniel DePinto, Elliot Esquivel, Laureen Carichu, and Keandra Hunt. So I want to give a shout out to the School of Theater and Dance and these particular students from Texas Tech who did such a great job. And look, the debate was fabulous. The individuals playing Hamilton, who was a man named Ian Rose, and Jefferson, who was a guy named Bill Barker, were fabulous, and the crowd loved it, but they were blown away by these kids and their performance. They were really, really great. And so these very, very talented singers were, you know, deserve a shout out.
Okay.
What about you, David? Yeah, and as you said, and I got their institution wrong.
Well, you know, as long as that's the most embarrassing thing about you on the internet, then you're doing okay.
As you know, David, we all speak for a living, and the longer you speak for a living, the more mistakes you'll make.
This is to be sure. Okay. So I think as many listeners know, I've been doing some events in connection with this book I just had come out on Surrender, which we talked about in our last episode. But subsequent to being in Charlottesville with Frank, I went to Richmond, where I got to speak at the new American Civil War Museum, which actually I didn't actually get to speak at the new American Civil War Museum because they were still under construction when I was in Richmond. So they put me in the basement of the White House of the Confederacy, which the museum runs. So I was in Jefferson Davis's basement, which I think is appropriate in all levels for my little speaking gig. But I got to see a preview of the new American Civil War Museum, which was still under construction then, and recently, I think last weekend, had its grand opening. And this museum is amazing. It's really for those of you who aren't familiar with the story behind this museum, grows out of, in some ways, the old Museum of the Confederacy, which is a interesting institution in and of itself, which and it merged with another museum that was based in Richmond to form this new museum. It's in the old Tredegar Iron Works, so it's right in the middle of downtown Richmond on the river in this historic site, and it's got an amazing collection and a really the new displays in terms of interpreting the Civil War, making the Civil War make sense in a 21st century context. It does a really an extraordinary job. So if you are in the Richmond area, I highly recommend visiting the new American Civil War Museum in Old Tredegar. So Frank, you need to make a trip up there from Charlottesville when you get a chance.
Excellent. I will try to do that before I go.
Go. All right.
Excellent.
So until next week, guys, cheers.
Thank you. Thanks, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.